In this interview, we take a look at the future in 360.
This is Twit.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of This Week in Photo. I am your host, Frederick Van Johnson. Today on the show, I have my good friend, Mr. Mark Charette. Mark is down in Australia, and he's doing some pretty cool stuff, as you will find out in just a second. Mark specializes, he's a photographer first and foremost, but he specializes in local SEO and how to help small businesses and medium and I guess some large businesses get found on the internet. But as a photographer, he's sort of a one-stop shop for that. So because you can go to places and get headshots done, you can go over here, get 360s done of your business, or you can get product shots done over here. Mark does all of that stuff and handles the SEO and a bunch of other things so that the clients that contact him can get found on the internet. So Mark is here to chat with us about how he does all that. Mark Charette, welcome to the show, man. How are you doing?
Great, great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. This is going to be good. So that was a mouthful in that intro, man. You do a lot, and I'm assuming. I don't want to make any assumptions, but are you a one man shop there, or how do you have your business set up?
Well, yeah, actually, I do. I have some strong associations with web developers and a few other people, but that's generally speaking, all the work is done through me. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So take me through it. I did my best at that intro to try to, paint the picture of what a day in the life of Mark Charette looks like. But yeah. Why don't you do it? Like, what when people you're at a cocktail party or you're talking to someone new or your elevator pitch and they say, "Oh, Mark, what do you do?" I mean, you can just say photographer if you don't really care about the person, but if you want to give them a level deeper, what do you say?
Yeah, I generally tell people that what I do is I help them first get found, then look great once they get found, and then have people talking nicely about them once they've actually found them. And it's because of the fact that nowadays in the world of online marketing and content and video and 360 virtual tours, Google Street View, which is still a core product for me, what people really want in business is for them to increase their sales. They want to increase their engagement with their clients. And it takes several parts of that puzzle to work well together. And what I found is that there's three areas that really tend to be the things that they need the most amount of help with, that are skills and expertise that I can provide. And then I will often refer to other people who can help them in the other areas that I don't actually have an expertise in, such as web development and web design and web SEO.
Yeah. And how does that market look down there? I mean, what you told me before we started recording is you're doing local SEO versus just generic across the board SEO. What does that look like? Is that, just keywording, or what's the nuts and bolts of local SEO?
Local SEO is based on the idea, and I take people back to, let's go back to before the days of the internet. We had essentially directories, and mostly yellow pages is the place where you would list your business, right? And that's what we would think of as being what you would do to make sure you're found, or you'd have the local news rags and that kind of thing, or the white pages. But now, obviously, most of that data has gone online, and even the yellow pages is online. All these organizations, that's where they've gone. And at the core of that is Google Maps and Google Street Views, Google My Business platform. That's really the single most important place for businesses to be found. But then how does Google make sure that you rank well, as a local business? Is they take that data along with the data from all kinds of other mapping platforms and directory platforms. We could say Apple Maps, Bing Maps, TripAdvisor listings, anything that could be a directory of any kind. That's where that data basically resides and helps you get found locally. So that's really what that part of my business is about. It's helping businesses first understand that the yellow pages is gone. The book's been dead for a long time.
Yeah, it's a doorstop. Yeah,
it's a doorstop, right? And we I used to work for these guys years ago, and they're wonderful people. But and they've changed their business model. They've moved obviously a lot more online too. But making sure that a business is actually able to be found on these platforms is really the key starting point, and making sure that data is very consistent. One of the things that's actually core to that is something called the NAP, which is the name, address, and phone number of a business. You can obviously add to that their website and their social media connections. Those types of things are also very important. But at the core is still the name, address, and phone number, which is how you actually find a business. And making sure that that data is absolutely consistent across multiple platforms. And that's where I start to help businesses as most.
And what do you find the... Or a better way to phrase the question would be the tech savviness of the local businesses that you're dealing with. Kind of the stereotype is, you know, mom and pop shops aren't tech savvy. They don't understand what all this internet stuff is. But, you know, that's a stereotype, and we know how stereotypes go, right? So what from the horse's mouth, are your clients savvy? Do you just need like a little bit of push to sort of figure out and iron out the wrinkles? Or do you have to do a fair amount of hand-holding to get them into the flow?
Generally speaking, I would say that if I speak to a small business owner, you know, let's say a cafe, restaurant, a hotel or motel, a pub, those types of people will usually have a very good idea of what it is. But if you ask them to, you know, go in there and actually start updating that data on a regular basis, that'll scare them. Okay. It can be very, very tedious. And if they're a big enough operation where they've actually got staff that can do this for them, then that's great. That's probably their best bet, is to actually direct someone on their team. But very rarely do they actually have someone on their team who, number one, actually has that knowledge and then can apply it in a consistent manner. That's really difficult to find. So that's where I see most of the challenge tends to be, is more with small businesses, medium businesses, and even large. When I say large, I'm not talking about the multinationals or multi-location businesses, but anybody who's at, you know, a relatively large hotel or that kind of thing, they often will struggle with that same stuff too.
Now, do you see that as sort of the industry that you're in? The way that I see it from the outside is I hear about SEO, like you said, all the time, and I use the blanket term SEO. You know, when you corrected me and you said no, what you're doing is local SEO. Is that sort of an untapped space? You know, as I see a lot of SEO specialists that are helping people get their page ranked in Google and, you know, helping Fortune 500 companies do this or this photographer do that. But it's always, you know, pulling strings and sprinkling on the secret Google sauce to help them bubble up in the search listings. But you're working with clients that you can walk down the street or drive, you know, across town to talk to. What's the main differences between what you're doing and, say, those other people that are working with people on the other side of the planet?
Well, they actually tend to work more on the actual content of the website. Mm-hmm. So, for example, making sure the keywords, the href tags, all that technical stuff that's inside of a site to make sure that it ranks well. And that's a very, very important component. I would never take away what they're doing as being, of less importance than what I do. But they work hand in hand. And the area that I specialize in, obviously, is because it's local SEO, it's all about geographical information. It's about businesses that do business with clients that are geographically within a certain reach or range. And so, for example, if you're an online business that's selling shoes online, and I've got a client, I actually did a shoot for her, did some product 60s for her, and she doesn't need local SEO work from me. That's not the kind of service that she would require. But recently I did a training center for a builders association. And in their case, they want to make sure that their training center is easy to find. And so I'm actually helping them with that part of things. Same thing would apply with something called an RSL club, which is very common here in Australia. They're the returning servicemen's clubs they have a combination of halls and cafes and kid play centers and, you know, pool tables and the whole bit. So they have the need to actually get found again on a local basis. Same thing would apply with hotels or motels or bed and breakfasts, that kind of thing.
That's interesting. That is so cool. I mean, congratulations, first of all, on what you're doing. It sounds like a business that you've built that allows you to sort of, you know, cater to multiple sides of the stuff that you like doing, right? And one of them, that I want to switch gears and talk about away from the SEO stuff and into more of the practical stuff is the 360 degree photography stuff that you do.
Sure.
You and I first came into contact with each other, and we were talking about that, you know, just sort of that whole world and the ecosystem, which back then wasn't as mature as it is now. You know, I don't think back then we had thetas and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, now it's actually like everybody seems to have a 360. Well, I shouldn't say everybody, but a lot of people have 360 cameras in their pockets, especially photographers that are far more familiar with it. And, you know, we can credit the Theta as being one of the major ones in that space. But there's been other developments in that area. Now, there was a period of time when it almost seemed, I'm sure it's not the case, but it seemed as if there was a new 360 camera coming out every 3 months.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's because of the fact that it sounds like VR, and it is in a way, because you can use VR technology along with 360 photography. They are interconnected. It had a sexy kind of sound to it, so people really got interested in that space. And but what's happened now is it's gotten to the point where there are some social cameras. There's even much better equipment out there, and so it's democratizing the space a lot more. So we're seeing an awful lot more of a range of quality being published in 360 photography now.
Yeah. I mean, back when you and I were talking initially, it was, you know, you talk about range of quality. I think if memory serves, back then, we didn't even have consumer reachable 4K video 360 cameras.
No.
Right, and now they're here en masse, right? You can throw a rock and hit one. Back then, it was kind of like, when are we going to get these 4K?
Exactly. Absolutely. In fact, actually, one of the things I found quite fascinating is when last year the Insta360 Pro version 2 came out, which was, that's sort of the, I don't want to say it's the top end, but it's pretty close to being the top end of that particular camera, where it's shooting 30 frames a second at 8K. You know, in 3D. So it's actually doing full stereoscopic photography or videography. That's pretty impressive for, I don't want to call it a box because it's actually a ball. It looks like a black basketball, and it's, you know, probably under $10,000.
Yeah. Which is just crazy. Yeah. I've seen that thing, and it looks like, it looks like alien tech, you know, like you'd be, okay, we need to get some data on this strange tunnel, you know, like on Aliens, and you throw that thing down the tunnel and it scans. That's what it kind of looks like with all those lenses on there. So Mark, what does your kit look like? You know, your loadout, you're on a job, you know, small business XYZ calls you over and they're like, you know what, we need the whole shebang, dude. We need you to help us. Yep. We need, you know, visuals. We need the 360 stuff. We need headshots. We need product shots. What do you do? What does that first meeting or that first week look like in a day in the life?
Okay, well, but for me, I'm a Canon shooter, but it's like I don't really even care because it's not about the gear. It is about the gear because it's very technical equipment that you have to have, but it's more of a technical process. But, you know, I shoot most of my headshots and product photography with a 60, and, you know, and the virtual tours are shot with a 70D. I used to shoot with a 7D, and it's just getting old, so I just replaced it and went to a 70D. It's all, you don't need any more than that, because fact of the matter is when you're stitching a 360 photo, you're actually going to end up with a 60, 70, 80 megapixel image in the end, and that's pretty big already. So there's no point in trying to, for publishing on Google Street View, to go a whole lot bigger than that. In fact, I think their limit is somewhere around 100 megapixels. That's where they max out. So there's no point in actually going beyond that scope. But it's still a heck of a lot better than what you'd see in a one-shot camera. If you think about it, you know, like the Insta360 will actually shoot an 8K image. But that's still not 70 megapixels. We're not quite to that resolution.
Yeah.
So that's what I shoot with. So it's pretty straightforward gear. It's a lot of people, when I they see the way I set up, I don't even put a ball head on my tripod because I've got the head that actually holds the lens is directly attached to the tripod. And all I do to make sure that I'm perfectly straight is just adjust the legs on the tripod. That's it.
Cool.
it's less gear. It's less to worry about. I want to keep it simple. I've got to get in, do the job, get the shots, and get back to publishing. So
That is cool. Are you doing any sort of like real estate photography as well? I can imagine some of these small businesses would be like, you know, we want exterior beauty shots, and you know, if it's a restaurant, we want people enjoying our food inside. Do you do all that stuff as well?
I do some of that. What I tend to like to do now, and this is something that's one of the areas where that's shifted a lot, is Back when we first spoke, one of the things that was a standard policy for Google is they weren't really big fans of having people in the imagery. It's practically a standard policy that if there was people in it, you had to blur their faces, which was kind of a bad look. So it ended up having most of the virtual tours I was shooting at that time. A restaurant would be empty or a cafe would be empty. Now what I do is I tend to stage it a lot more. So I'll bring people in, we get them to sign off model release forms so they can be used for the marketing side of things. But then it's a little more alive. The key is to find that balance between having it look good, but not so bloody busy that you can't see the restaurant.
Yeah.
The back of it. So, yeah, but I do actually like to include a lot of people in the way that, I work now. It's a far more alive feel to the.
One of the things that I'm really curious about is street view, right? Mm-hmm. That seems to be like a mystery to a lot of photographers as to how it all works. I mean, most of us have used it, you know, in Google Maps, and you know, you click the little guy, you look in there, you can kind of look around, and it's like, wow, they got my street. When did they do that? You know, I've seen those street view cars driving around and doing that sort of thing. Contrast what that stuff is, you know, sort of the automated, or not automated, but the, you know, Google crisscrossing the world with their cars versus what you're doing, which is interiors for the most part, right?
That's right. Correct. Keeping in mind, too, though, that actually as of the Google Street View Summit this past year in 2018, which took place in San Francisco, I didn't go, but I watched a lot of the videos and a lot of the announcements. Google is actually moving more and more towards it's more like as if they want to give the ability for anyone to publish on Street View, including, get this, streets themselves. That's actually part of what seems to be up and coming now, because they, in fact, if you buy an Insta360 Pro, you can get a car mount kit, put it on top of your car, and drive along and update Street View now. It's actually being done in certain areas in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. So that whole democratization made me think, well, and I think there's a real question that's happening now in our space is, what if Google starts to take the cars off the road and it becomes the responsibility of local government or state government, or for that matter, you know, federal level. I don't know who it would be. Obviously, the road and traffic authorities, generally speaking, that they may be the ones who have to do their own updates if they want it updated. Fact is Google spends an awful lot of money doing this. And how are they monetizing that, right?
Yeah.
So we have to think about what's coming next. So that was a particularly interesting element that's taken place in this past year. The other thing that they did is they actually didn't invite a lot of the Google Street View virtual tour photographers who do the inside of businesses. They were more interested in going after the DMOs, destination management organizations, because their move is far more towards encouraging virtual tours and Street View on a much larger scale. So we're talking about the tourism industry. We're talking about larger scale stuff. So that's where Google is going with this stuff at this point. And so, but we all use the same technology. In terms of how it's published, they're all still images. So basically it's not shot, even if it's shot with a video camera or in video mode, you'd still be taking stills from that video mode to publish in Street View, because you are actually looking at the equivalent of a time-lapse shoot when they're doing it with the car. That's exactly what they do.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I've seen video 360s, right?
Yes.
Where you can get in the scene and look around, and there's birds flying, and there's the ocean over there, and it sort of give it with stereoscopic sound as well. So when you look over there, the sound kind of follows you around.
Absolutely.
Is that part of the future? Because it seems, I know obviously stills are going to be less heavy in terms of data transfer, but video seems like it'd be kind of cool, especially if I could go to Coachella and hang out there, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's actually more where things are going to end up going, I believe, over the long haul. I think a good example of that, or a good precursor to that, was the movie Ready Player One. If I don't know if you had a chance to watch that.
Oh, dude, I read the book and watched it.
I came here and it was fabulous. It was just an amazing story and well put together. And it does provide some inkling as to where things are going to be going. And that is a matter of the convergence between the true VR world, which is the virtual, in other words, made up world, along with reality, So when you actually, and that's why they're also calling this XR, which is mixed reality. Hmm. So that what we have is the ability to actually interact in amongst these two spaces. That's where things I believe is going, where they're going to go. And audio is a very important part of that. Absolutely. I tell people all the time that when it comes to good quality audio and video, and especially, and this is something that you've been very, very proficient with, is with good audio in doing podcasting. It's like, mm-hmm. you can close your eyes, but you can't close your ears.
Yeah.
So it has to be good. So that's actually a big part of what good VR is all going to be about in the future.
I'm excited for that. Well, keep your futurist hat on for a second. And
sure.
Looking, because that kind of thing seems like it's within reach, because the technology's here right now to be able to do that, the fluctuating bandwidth speeds notwithstanding around the globe.
Yeah.
What does it look like? We're nearing 2020 right now. What does it look like in 2040, in terms of what the landscape looks like? In my science fiction nerd head, I'm thinking, well, psychiatry and therapy and those sorts of businesses will, yes. the brick and mortar components of those will be obviated, because now you can just go into the VR room in your home and sit mm-hmm. down with your therapist with your goggles on, maybe, or maybe not, and have a conversation. Are we moving? Do you think in your head, do you think, our kids' kids or our kids or whatever, are they going to have sort of that holodeck type experience in the future?
I think it's very possible. In fact, I think to some degree it's inevitable. The question I think that's more difficult to answer is the pace at which it'll be accepted into the consumer realm, because it really is still where it sits best still is as a commercial product or service at this point in time. And it's hard to, other than gaming, of course, because that's the gaming industry has been there for quite a while, actually. You look at what's actually happening with the Oculus and those guys.
Yeah.
But what we're, if you think about it as a highly accepted format, there's a couple of major stumbling blocks that we're going to need to get past. Number one, we got to get rid of the headset. It's just like the VR headset thing. It's uncomfortable. It's cumbersome. It's geeky. Mm-hmm. It's got to go away. So it's almost as if we were able to return to the Google Glass sized type of device. If that's where we were able to go, then I think that it becomes far more an acceptable technology on a consumer mass scale.
Yeah.
I think that's an important factor, but we're still a ways from that. 2025 is my guess as to when that becomes a little bit more accepted.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's even longer.
But we're seeing lots of cool stuff happen now. Like Google is experimenting, I think they're still in beta with augmented VR in Google Maps, where you can walk around and with your phone, kind of like what Yelp was doing. I don't know if they're still doing it, but you can hold up your phone and look at data overlaid in real time in 3D space over buildings and roads and, arrows being painted on roads to tell you where to go and things like that. Exactly. I see that stuff. And the first thing that my brain goes to is like, that is fantastic if you could just get rid of the phone, right? If I could have that technology, say, in glasses or at the least in a heads up display in my car that's overlaying road telemetry real time as I'm driving on it. That's kind of science fiction right there. Do you think will we get to that while I still care about it?
I would say yes, that's actually very likely. And I think that that's not that far away. There's a lot of technology that's already in place that's capable of doing it. But you mentioned earlier on and it's one of the things that I think is going to be the major playing card in this is the speed of our internet connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
4G is pretty good. It's probably sufficient in many respects. 5G, I think, is the real major turning point where this is going to become a standard thing. But then again, if we look at the way that 5G technology is supposed to be going, where it requires these little nodes to retransmit the signal all over the place, it's complex and it's not going to be for everyone everywhere for a while. It's just a very expensive technology to implement. So that's why I tend to tell people as much as possible, although all this technology is absolutely fabulous, we still have to have our feet planted in reality right here, right now, which is why continuing down the path of leveraging the 360 photos as they stand today is probably the most efficient way to manage or the transition process or to get used to that. That's to me where it's going to take a while to get to that point where it's really usable for, by everyone, but it is coming. There's no doubt.
Yeah, it's definitely coming. It's definitely a train. It's just at the end of the tunnel. It's just how big is that light right now? You know, I love geeking out with you because this is fantastic. I was reading this article, or I don't know if it was a video or something I was watching, but it was talking about one of these car companies. I don't know if it was an Audi or Lexus or someone like that, but they'd come out with a car, or they had a concept of a car where the passengers in the car could wear VR headsets, and the car itself would translate the G-force data of the car into the virtual world that those people were living in, and then overlay, you know, different worlds outside. So when you turn, you'd feel the G-forces of the car turning, and you look around and there's a pterodactyl flying above the car, or, you know, you're in an open Jeep in Jurassic Park, you know, that, you know, do you think that, I mean, I saw that, I'm like, of course, you're going on a road trip, you know, who wants to stare at blank, you know, scenery? Yeah. You could put whatever you want out there. You think that's coming?
It is. In fact, the category in VR experiences that is defined by that is called haptics. Mm. And the world of haptics is another one that's still – of all the parts of the VR space, audio and video has been pretty well – I won't say mastered by any means, but we've got it pretty well figured out as to what it takes to make it convincing to the average person. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the haptics, which is the feel, that you know, that can get really complicated because you practically have to be wearing a full body suit at this point.
Like Ready Player One, right?
Ready Player One, exactly. Yeah. That's really what that was all about. It was demonstrating that if you're going to have full immersion, you need to be able to have your full sensory system, your whole body, be completely convinced that you're there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Do you worry? I mean, right now there's all this, you know, negativity around we're no longer connected to each other. We, you know, spouses will sit on the couch next to each other or lie in bed next to each other and text each other versus having a conversation. And, you know, little Johnny's texting from the dinner table and Facebook is, you know, there's this whole thing about we are no longer a connected society. We're just moving. We're physically in close proximity, but we're not mentally connected. What's your thoughts on VR? Is VR going to help get us closer or push us further away from that?
I'd say it'll do both, just like all the other technologies doing right now.
Yeah, right. Double-edged sword. Yeah,
exactly. It is very much that. Is the technology is just another tool. You know, back in the day, people used to build houses without power tools. Now, could you imagine anybody building a house without a power tool unless they're, I don't want to call them a Luddite, but they're definitely, you know, they like it the old-fashioned way, and that's cool.
Amish. Amish, yeah.
Absolutely. You know, and there's skills and knowledge to be had from that. So I believe that it's very much the same thing when it comes to technology. They have their rightful place. I think what we need to spend probably more time about is actually talking about it, as you and I are doing right now. Because the more we talk about it, the more we make sure that we keep in check with, are we going too far with it? Are we leveraging it in the most effective manner? Are we doing the right thing for ourselves and future generations with the technology?
Yeah. I don't know. It's you know, on the one hand, it's exciting because it's like all this stuff that the mind just reels with the possibilities of what you could do. You know, everything from, like we were talking about before, therapy and you know, psychiatry and that sort of thing, all the way down to private concerts that, you know, this, like, say John Legend or some artist decided, you know what, for 10 grand a ticket, I'm going to do a private concert, but only for 60 people, you know, here's your digitally signed access pass to get in, you know, to my event, put on your VR. And then I see, you know, like, Mark, back in the, I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but back in the day, there was, houses were built with, in the living room, with sort of coves where you fit your giant TV so it could sit inset in there. So the architecture was built for the technology. Now they don't do that because you can just hang a TV on the wall. Mm-hmm. In the future, my head goes to, you know what? We'll probably have little VR rooms where you can go. It's like a little closet, sort of, where you go in. There's refreshments in there, and you sit down, you put your headset on, and you go to wherever you want on the planet. You have meetings, you go to concerts, you get therapy, you know, whatever. Do you see that coming? Is that a reality that might happen?
it sort of has already been experimented with. There's, I can't remember exactly the name of the company, but I think they were called Igloo out of Vancouver, who built essentially what would be a hemisphere that you would sit in and you could watch full 3D VR content in that room. So what it made me think about is, are we going to start seeing dome houses come back as a new cool thing? Or are you going to have a dome room, right? Mm-hmm. Where sit on the inside of the dome and, you know, you've got projected content in that sense. So it's not an impossibility. It's more an issue of, I think, will we surpass that with other forms of practicalities to use technology in an even more efficient way without having to build the space where the physical space becomes less relevant?
Yeah. It's just crazy where things are going. I mean, because you look at like here, right? I'm showing you my my sort of set where I'm sitting right now. This is a green screen. Let me turn it off. So this is where I actually am. Right? I'm actually sitting in front of a green screen right now, and with the click of a mouse, I'm like, I can be wherever I want. Exactly. This was not possible. I mean, you know, it's been possible for a long time in television and all that, but for the average consumer like yours truly, it was not possible until just recently to be able to do this kind of thing reliably and convincingly. Right?
That's right.
And now we can do it reliably, and most people wouldn't even know that was a green screen until I told them, right? Exactly. So now we can do that, and it's only 2019 that we're at now. Yeah. So what's the future hold for this? I mean, is it, you know, our kids are just going to be like, you know what, this kind of stuff is just passe, whatever. It's all about X. And what is X?
Mm-hmm, exactly. I do believe that eventually it will become that easy for people to just get immersed in the technology. They won't think twice of it. We're pretty close to that in some ways with, just think of how kids will gravitate, pick up a mobile phone and figure out how to use it. And there was no training involved. They just used it. You know, where did that come from? I think that will be the same thing with the VR technologies as they develop. But I don't know how far it'll go before we hit some stumbling blocks. And I think generally speaking, no different than the Moore's Law kind of did a bit of a stumbling recently in terms of speed increases, because really we ran into a problem with internet speeds being really the holding pattern. That's, I think, what we have to think about with VR is what will be that holding pattern that'll hold the technology from moving forward any further. And I'm not sure what that is as of yet. There's probably people a lot smarter than me that have some pretty cool ideas. In fact, actually, I'll mention one of my friends, John Warkenton. He's quite a tech buff, and he's been in this business a lot longer than I have. And he's always had these crazy ideas about how you could create VR cameras that are actually almost like a bug eye. You know, it's just, this guy's got some brilliant ideas as to what you could do. And that, from a content creation perspective, would actually be far more accurate in the data collection. Because we have to think about, when it comes to VR, it's, yes, it's the space in which we experience it, but there's also the challenges in the creation of it that we have to think about first. Because if you didn't create it, you're not going to experience it. So we got to get that part of things in order first.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about. I had a guest on a couple weeks ago that was actually, he was an AI or engineer from I believe it was Skyloom and he and I were just sort of blue sky and kind of like what you were what we're doing here, but we were talking about what the future of artificial intelligence might be as it applies to photography. And he threw out that where he thinks things are going is not that this is the right thing or wrong thing, but it's still going to be possible. The idea that you can just describe a scene to a computer and it will just create it. You know, I mean, not even typing it. You just sit here in front of a microphone or whatever and just say, you know, I envision a white sandy beaches with a blue sky with puffy white clouds and maybe some seagulls flying over, and you can hear their voices in the background. But everyone on the beach is dressed in white for some reason. And, you know, so you just go on and describe this in detail, and the computer builds a realistic animated scene of what was in your mind's eye. And then, you know, part of the creation process is you just sit in a chair and you keep fine tuning that vision verbally until you have a piece of art. I mean, that can happen, right?
So what will really scare me is if we get to the point where I actually say, and I want to be sipping on a pina colada, and you've got a VR pina colada that you can actually taste.
Right.
Oh, that's pretty scary.
Yeah, because at that point you're at holodeck. That's holodeck level there. Because that, what I just described is what holodeck, if you're not a nerd and you don't understand what Star Trek is, that's it's a room on a spaceship where you can make anything happen, you know, and it happens sort of computer generated as a way for people that are stuck in space to actually come back and hang out at home or whatever.
Exactly.
But I think that's, you know, in some degree that, you know, the creators of Star Trek and those ilk of films were prophetic in some ways, right? Because a lot of that stuff is coming true. Look, the tablets came true. They were way back in the, 70s, they were talking about tablet-based computing, and we all thought that was like, yeah, whatever, a computer fills a room. How's it gonna be in a tablet? You know, and now we have our phones that can launch, you know, satellites if we wanted them to.
Right? Exactly. That reminds me, it's interesting you mentioned that, because in a prior life, back when I was in Canada, I used to manage Radio Shack stores.
I remember. I used to work at one. I sold Tandy computers, man.
Oh, so did I, man. Tandy 1000. I had one of those too.
Yeah.
But I mean, you may remember the little LCD TV sets that we used to sell at Radio Shack that were these, and at the time they were amazing. At first they were black and white, and that was cool. Then they actually got the color one that came out, and everybody was like, oh my God, how did you get color in this little thing that you can put in your pocket? But that's, you know, that technology was essentially the precursor of what we are seeing now. So there's no doubt, it's all possible. The question is, again, it's that whole thing of the speed at which it is being developed, the content creation side of it, which is the other major challenge, and then finally the ability to host and transmit it such that people can actually consume it. There's so many moving parts to this technology that have to be solved I don't want to say all at the same time, but close enough that the public remains interested in it.
I mean we could sit here and be futurists all day long, but you're right, there are certain hurdles. If we just talk about it technologically speaking, you know, bandwidth needs to get there. We need, you know, there's a lot of things that need to be put in place before we get to that utopian vision. And is it a utopian vision?
Yeah, I think that one of the things about that that's interesting, too, is that, and this, it goes back a little bit to why is it that Google has done what they've done in terms of, in some ways, opening up their platform for more content creation. You know, and that's why now, if you do own a Theta and you want to put a 360 on Google Maps, they won't stop you. It used to be that was too low of a grade. But they've opened it up, partly, I believe, is not because that they've lowered their standard per se, although it does actually lower the standard in terms of the quality of the images. But what it does is it increases the popularity and the accessibility for the average consumer to do the same thing and to use this technology. And you do need a large critical mass of people who accept that technology for it to actually get to the point where they can say, all right, now we're going to invest even more into this and make it so that the resolution's better, the experience is better.
Yeah. It's exciting. It's exciting, you know, and lots of overlay. There's always so much to talk to you about, man. So it's like we could geek out and talk about this stuff forever and ever. Photography, 360, you know, local SEO, Street View, all this stuff. So thank you for coming on. What's next for Mark Charette? What's in your future versus all of our futures?
Well, continuing to grow my business and focusing more and more on local businesses, getting them to understand the components that they require to make sure that they are being found properly, that they look good, and that, you know, and that they get people talking about them. Which is, so for me, it's more about developing my business model such that I have more recurring revenue, more long-term relationships with my clients, and I'm moving more and more towards that. You know, after having been in this business for 3.5, going on 4 years now, it's now becoming a little bit more, less of a need to be looking and hunting for new clients, but developing longer, deeper relationships with fewer clients and really, truly helping them develop a platform that helps them grow their business and let them connect with their clients more efficiently. That's really what I'm moving more and more towards now.
I love that. Who was it that said that as long as you build your business around helping others, you will always be successful, right?
That's absolutely critical. You know, one of the things that I've recently started up with a couple of friends of mine, one of them happens to be my web developer, is a LinkedIn local group, which has become sort of a very popular thing. It started actually in Australia, now it's grown internationally, where basically it's about getting people who meet online to actually meet offline. So it's reversing the process, getting people to reconnect in person. And we had our first couple of meetings last year, and the first one was 45 people. Next one, we had 90 people show up. We had another one a few months ago, or last month, was 60 some odd people. We've got over 100 people signed up already for this coming meeting that's coming on this Monday. Wow. And it's all local businesses, local entrepreneurs, people who want to connect. So it's about really, you're saying that whole thing about making sure we're connecting small businesses together and giving them the tools that they need so that they can succeed.
So if people want to sign up for that or connect with you or hire you, where should they go?
Easiest way to find, actually, LinkedIn is a great way to find me. I actually don't spend hardly any time at all on Facebook other than the groups that I belong to, where that's where the communication takes place. But if you actually look me up on LinkedIn, you can actually find me with markcharette.com, because I've actually got a redirect on that link. Or at my website, which is WorkPix, that's WORKPICS.com. That's the easiest way to find me.
All right, Mark Charette, thank you so much for coming on, man. It's always a pleasure, always educational. And you know what I'm going to do after we finish here? Mm-hmm. I'm going to go watch Ready Player One more time because of you. I'm not kidding.
It's good fun. It really is.
I love that. I mean, that movie speaks to me, right? The nerd part of me, the tech futurist part of me, and my upbringing with all the references to the 80s, right?
Well, for me, the first time I saw it and I heard music from Rush playing on it, and I went, oh my God, this is great. This is so me, because I'm a complete Rush nut. So it was, I'll probably do the same thing.
Yeah, you got it. You got to watch it again. Yeah, because there's so many Easter eggs in there. I mean, you just freeze frame and say, hey, there's Akira's motorcycle, and there's, the car from Tron, or the motorcycle from Tron, and, there's all kinds of stuff in there that you remember. I think everything in that film has some sort of nostalgic value to it. So,
it does. It's a great story. It really is.
All right. Mark Charette, thank you so much for coming on, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
See you soon. Take care.
All right. Take care.
This is Twitter.